listening, your exchange listening, by going online to nhpr.org, and we thank you so much.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. A mention of whaling for many Americans conjures romantic images of Moby Dick-era expeditions. As UNH historian Kirk Dorsey puts it, of wooden ships and iron men cruising the Pacific or nudging into the icy Arctic Ocean. But Dorsey leaves that era behind in his new book with what happened next. It's a 20th century story, which includes the rise of technologies that improve the safety and effectiveness of whaling, growing scientific concerns that whale populations were being depleted, futile efforts to regulate this increasingly unsustainable industry, the 1970s Save the Whales movement, all the way up to present-day threats to whale populations far greater than the harpoon, from ocean garbage to climate change. Today in The Exchange, UNH historian and author Kirk Dorsey on his new book, Whales and Nations, the story of multiple international attempts to regulate whaling in the 20th century and what it means for future conservation. Call in with your questions and comments. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. And Kirk Dorsey, it's been a while. It's good to see you. Welcome back.
Very good. Thank you.
Well, let's talk for just a moment about Moby Dick. That's the comment you say that you often received when you told people you were working on a whaling book. Everyone said, oh, Moby Dick. What does that frequent comment represent to you, Kirk, about people's impressions of whaling? And I have to ask you, too, did that frequent reference start to bother you after a while?
Not nearly as much as being called Captain Kirk is just something. I think that for most Americans, whaling is what America did in the 19th century, dominated the whaling and those wooden ships. And Moby Dick is the image of that. Most people have at least been exposed to it. They probably started it and stopped around page 50, and they realized that it was taking a long time to get to whenever the whaling started. And so for most people, when I mention whaling, they say, oh, the 19th century, you know, you're writing about the people coming out of New Bedford or out of Nantucket. And that was a really important era, and a lot of people have written great books about it, but that's not what my book is about. Mine is the next century when the American whaling effort was mainly to try to regulate it rather than actually participate in the industry.
Well, and it is fascinating because you're right, especially from New England, that's our image, you know, that's the pictures we all grew up with. But the 20th century is equally fascinating. It just maybe doesn't happen in that dramatic setting of wooden ships and iron men, as you put it.
Exactly, and I think we still have this image when people read Moby Dick, there's sort of romance of the challenge that the whales have the fighting chance, right? The white whale takes out Captain Ahab's ship. And so in the modern era, in the 20th century, the whales have no chance. The ships are much more powerful. The harpoons are more powerful. And so there's nothing remotely romantic about the modern era of whaling. And it seems to be instead this sort of depressing story of the whales under relentless assault.
Yeah. So when did whaling shift, Kirk, away from that, you know, again, the wooden ships?
Really, for the United States, it ends with the Civil War because the Confederate raiders take off after whaling ships because they're incredibly valuable. Insurance rates go through the roof, and the whaling industry takes a big hit. And then the whaling industry is also attacked by the rise of petroleum because whale oil in the 19th century is used as a fuel for lamps. So in the early 20th century, whaling is a marginal industry. Whale oil is an inferior industrial fat, as one scientist calls it. And then there are a couple breakthroughs in the 1920s. One of the biggest is that they figure out how to refine whale oil to make it into margarine. And at that point, whale oil enters the market again. The international market is a really valuable commodity.
Yeah, that's real interesting. And a couple of us were talking about this yesterday as we got ready for the show today. So earlier on, whale oil was vital, right?
Yes.
For lamps and so forth.
Yes.
And then as that fell out of favor, as people discovered petroleum, so what do people use it for in this country? We'll talk about other countries in a minute.
Use the whale oil?
Yeah.
So in the 20th century, whale oil is actually not much of a product in the United States because there's so many other sources of, well, butter and then even later margarine from plants and other sources. So
sure, corn.
Interestingly, yeah, corn. The whale oil is almost all going into the European market. And in addition, the American market is protected by a high tariff, so it's very hard to get whale oil into the United States unless it's by an American company. So it's just not profitable for American companies to hunt whales in the 20th century and bring oil into the United States. It's not, there's not really a need for it. So it's really dominated by the Norwegians and the British. And then briefly, the Germans and Japanese get into it in the 1930s. And then after World War II, it gets far more complex than that.
So did Americans ever eat whale meat, or was it more about the oil?
There's some whale meat, but it's for instance, in the World Wars, particularly World War I, whale meat is unrationed, and they still can't get anybody to eat it. It has a very strong taste, particularly sperm whales, pretty much unpalatable, I understand. And it's also very difficult because the other big change is that the whales in the 20th century that are being hunted are all down around Antarctica, whereas in the earlier years, they had been in the Arctic and the Pacific and a little more accessible. So getting whale meat from Antarctica up to northern population centers, it requires a lot of refrigeration, a lot of effort, and the meat is usually frozen. So the time it's frozen and thawed, it's basically not a very popular meat. I've been in Norway a couple of times, and it's available, but it's not even common there, and they hunt whales right off the coast of Norway.
Well, we'll talk about that in a minute, where yes. They're still hunting whales mm-hmm. and who's still using whale products. I think I read in your book, too, Kirk, that whale oil at one point was used in pet food. Is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and particularly whale meat. So that one of the things they did so the whaling companies in the 20th century are these huge industrial conglomerates, and there's an incredible amount of money invested in the ships. And so anything they can do to squeeze penny of profit out of a whale, they have to do. So what they realized pretty quickly is that the whale oil is maybe 50% of the value of a whale. All this rest of the whale that's being squeezed down to get the oil, they could just throw it overboard, or they could start drying it out and call it whale meal or grind it up as whale meat. And a lot of that ends up as pet food and also food for farm animals. Chickens, for instance, chicken feed, a lot of that is made from whale meat, particularly after World War II. And the Soviet whaling industry, one of the big reasons for it is to provide meat for the fur farms in the far north. And so the whale meat goes not only to pet food, but also for domestic animal production.
Wow.
Yes.
I want to invite our listeners to join us, and then so much more to unravel from this book. The exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Join us as we look at the history and legacy of the whaling industry in the 20th century, a history much less known than that earlier romantic New England whaling era. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Email exchange@nhpr.org. I also want to remind you that it's NHPR's March Fund Drive. You can do your part for NHPR with a contribution of any amount. Go to NHPR.org and thank you. So, Kirk, you mentioned the Norwegians and the Brits earlier on in the 20th century. So this sounds like it's largely, at least in terms of the whaling industry, not an American story. The Americans are very involved in the conservation efforts later on, but this is taking place outside of our borders.
Right, and I think that's one of the interesting parts about American conservation efforts is that it grows out of a progressive era sense from the early 20th century that Americans have an obligation and a history of preserving wildlife and preserving wild spaces. And so there's a move afoot during the war, particularly World War II, to take control of whaling policy around the world and set up a sustainable whaling regime. Even though the Americans aren't catching whales, they do have an interest in sperm whale oil, which is an incredibly valuable industrial lubricant. And so this is something that's valuable to the United States. So it's not completely altruistic. But at the same time, the person who's leading the United States into this is a scientist from the Smithsonian named Remington Kellogg, who becomes the de facto whale expert for the United States because he's free, not because he has any particular expertise. He's actually an expert in fossil whales, not living whales. But he becomes involved in a whaling diplomacy in the 1930s and makes a decision in the 40s that Britain and Norway cannot possibly lead a sustainable whaling regime, so he's going to. And he gets the State Department backing and comes fairly close to getting it done. He makes a lot of progress.
It's tricky, though, isn't it? Because you've got that conservation ethic that, you know, stemmed from Teddy Roosevelt and that whole era, and that infuses the American society of let's preserve open spaces and wildlife and so forth. But then you've got the Americans kind of trying to impose that ethic on an unwilling world, so to speak.
Yes, and the world is half willing, half unwilling. Everybody involved in whaling understands that there's been a pattern of unsustainable whaling. One of the things that was most surprising to me was finding people in 1911 and 1913 saying, we're about to do it again. We've done this repeatedly for whale populations, and we're going to do it again. And they did. Everybody knew they were going to do it, and they still did it. But the problem was getting everybody on board for what a sustainable regime would look like. And so to me, the most interesting part of this was in the occupation of Japan, when the United States could, in fact, impose its vision and impose that vision in 1946. And it seems to me the Japanese are still whaling under the 1946 framework mentally of what it meant to use whales effectively.
Earlier in the 20th century, who were the villains? It seems like Norway's kind of a villain.
Well, you know, Norway is an interesting country because it's a country that got most of its wealth of this time period from whaling. It was a relatively poor agricultural country that got a lot of money from whale oil. And while it's true the Norwegians caught a lot of whales, I think the Norwegians also were more interested in trying to figure out the scientific limits on what they could catch. And they were whaling within a framework where they couldn't imagine that they could actually strip the Antarctic waters of the great whales. And so there are a number of Norwegians warning the world, in particular their own whalers, that they were going to stretch too far.
That it was
unsustainable. I think actually the British are probably more responsible for the problems because Norwegians try to organize themselves and put caps on the industry in the 1930s. And it's the British whalers who frequently won't cooperate. And so the big problem, even in the 1930s, is that a Norwegian whaling firm that doesn't want to live by the social or political pressure to conform just switches over to a British flag or somebody else's flag. They could go get the flag of Argentina and live by Argentina's rules rather than Norway's rules. So the flag of convenience problem is a huge issue for 20th century whaling. You've got to get everybody on board or the whalers will just shift to another country where they can do what they want.
The flag of convenience.
Yes.
It's not as hard as getting citizenship.
It's not nearly as hard. You just pay your fee. And if you happen to Panama, I'll talk about Aristotle and Onassis later, but Panama becomes a flag of convenience country where many ship owners realize that they can have much more flexibility in how they run their ships if they fly the Panamanian flag than if they fly the American or Norwegian or British flag.
So if you're a whaler who doesn't really care about sustainability, you just want to get out there and get your profit now, you find the nation that has the lowest bar in terms of whaling regulations, and you go purchase one of those flags, and boom, you're done.
And fortunately, I shouldn't say fortunately, that I don't want to pass the value judgment, but what Norway has a hammerlock on is trained harpooners, because it's actually really hard to hit a whale on the high seas with a harpoon and do it right. And so the Norwegians figure out the exploding harpoon, and then they have trained most of the skilled harpooners. So when the Japanese get into whaling in the 1930s, the big problem they have is nobody knows how to really use a harpoon effectively. And so they're terribly ineffective in the first few years because it's really hard. You'd think it'd be easy to hit a 90-ton whale. But the whale's running away, and you're in the seas, and it's bucking, and it's hard. And so the Norwegians actually are able in the 30s to try to put some sort of restraints on whaling by controlling their trained harpooners. And actually, after World War II, they pass a law saying you can't, if you're Norwegian, you can't leave Norway to work for another country unless it's abided by certain conservation standards.
Wow.
So they tried within their limits. But of course, they weren't about to give up their profits either.
We will talk a lot more after a short break. More on the history of whaling in the 20th century and efforts to conserve whales. More with Kirk Dorsey in just a moment, but let's check in with our March Fund Drive.
Thanks, Laura. That number is 1-888-805-6477. The work of Laura Kanoy and the team on the exchange, that's only made possible with listener support. Please give as generously as you can to keep stories, interviews like this coming. I'm Michael Brindley. Here's Amanda Loader with more.
Once again, please call 1-888-805-6477 and help pay for the programs you depend on. We've got a goal of $1,000 this hour with, just about 40 minutes left to go. So you can give online at nhpr.org or call 1-888-805-6477.
The Exchange is the only daily call-in talk show in the state. You can't get to the State House regularly to talk to the policymakers, so The Exchange brings them to you. You can't drive all over New England for all the author talks and lectures you'd like to go to, so again, The Exchange brings them to you right in your house. Call right now. Support this type of programming by calling us at 1-888-805-6477 or make your contribution online to nhpr.org.
And spring training is underway. Baseball season is just around the corner. And you know what? You don't want to be seen at the ballpark without your team colors. We have an NHPR baseball hat, and you get that when you make a $10 monthly donation and become a sustaining member. And here's the key thing. It comes in red or blue with the NHPR logo embroidered in white. It's also a one-size-fits-all design, so it makes it a perfect gift for the NHPR fan in your life. And the way you get that hat is by calling now, making your donation at 1-888-888. 805-6477 or by going to nhpr.org.
Every day, new people find NHPR. Maybe you recently started listening and you've become reliant on the excellent news coverage you hear and those excellent discussions you hear every day on The Exchange. Maybe you love Car Talk or This American Life or Radiolab as well. We're glad you found us and we welcome you. However, unlike a theater that sells tickets or a magazine that sells subscriptions, we have no idea who's listening to the station until you make your donation to support the service you enjoy. That's your way of paying for the programming you hear every day here on NHPR. So give us a call at 1-888-805-6477. Make your first-time gift to NHPR today. Make it a great day. Go online to nhpr.org and make your contribution there.
And we have 38 minutes and $1,000 left to raise for this hourly goal. Meeting that goal, it helps ensure that NHPR has the money needed to pay for the exchange 4 months to come. You can make a huge dent in this $1,000 goal by just a dollar a day. If the exchange worth it to you? I will say that when I first moved here, one of the first things I was asked when I said I worked at NHPR, oh my God, do you know Laura? I listen to her every day on the exchange. Well, yeah, you know what? There's a lot of people that do. If you're one of those, maybe consider that dollar a day to help us chip away at this goal in a big way. The number to call is 1-888-805-6477. You can also go to nhpr.org.
There are many good things we do to sustain ourselves. We eat good food, we exercise to sustain our bodies, and we sustain our connection to the world by listening to NHPR. You sustain your connection to New Hampshire every day by hearing these great in-depth discussions on The Exchange. When you become a sustaining member of NHPR, your monthly contribution provides sustenance to keep NHPR and The Exchange strong and healthy throughout the year. So make your sustaining gift right now. Maybe it's $10 a month, maybe $20 a month, maybe $50 a month if you have the means. Give us a call right now at 1-888-805-6477. Put a value on your NHPR listening by going online to nhpr.org.
And one of our thank you gifts, once again, is the NHPR baseball hat. It's a typical canvas hat, and it comes in red or blue, your choice, and it has the NHPR logo embroidered on the front. It's also 100% cotton with an easily adjustable strap for the back of your head. And, you know, it's a stylish, nice way to keep the sun out of your eyes and wear your team colors as we get ready for baseball season. So pick up the NHPR baseball hat. That's for a $10 a month sustaining gift by calling 1-888-805-6477 or going online to nhpr.org.
Once again, $1,000 is our goal for this hour, a little more than half an hour to get there. Exchange fans, we are calling out to you. Now is the time to make your contribution directly to The Exchange by giving us a call right now at 1-888-805-6477 or by going online to nhpr.org.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 924. Good morning. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, during our March Fund Drive. And support also comes to us from Dartmouth-Hitchcock, primary care doctors and nurses who put you at the center of health. 13 locations statewide. Information at d-hdocs.org. From the Maids of Southern New Hampshire, providing environmentally friendly house cleaning to the Seacoast, Greater Manchester, and Concord areas. Referred for a reason. MaidsNH.com. And Royalty Automotive, Volvo specialist for over 15 years, dedicated exclusively to the care and repair of Volvos, located in Barrington and online at royaltyautomotive.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're sitting down with UNH historian Kirk Dorsey about his new book called Whales and Nations. It's a look at the history and legacy of the whaling industry in the 20th century. We invite you to join us with your questions and comments. Call in 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can find us on Twitter or post a comment on our Facebook page. NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And Kirk, just before the break, we were talking about this idea of flag of convenience, where those whaling companies that didn't like the rules and regulations of their home countries could just, you know, pay a certain fine and go to another country that had much more lax regulations and then go out and whale to their heart's content. It's kind of a creepy concept when you think that this, you know, that the whales were being depleted globally. And it's a concept that's in the introduction to this book, The Tragedy of the Commons. Just yes. Remind us what that is.
Well, way back in 1968, Garrett Hardin wrote this famous article in the journal Science called The Tragedy of the Commons. And he argued that any time a group of people are sharing a common resource. In his case, it was people putting cows on pastures. There is a strong economic incentive for each person to maybe slip an extra cow onto the pasture. And if the cow could hold 100, if the pasture could hold 100 cows, eventually you'd end up with 105, 110 because people would keep slipping extra cows to make money for themselves. And it was refined by a great historian named Arthur McAvoy, who talked about the fisherman's problem, which is on the oceans, it's very similar. If you don't take the fish because you want to conserve fish, somebody else will come and take them because that person will get the immediate profit. And so your restraint is not going to be rewarded overall. Your restraint is going to be punished. So you're kind of foolish. And so McAvoy was writing about the ways in which law and cultural constraints can be used and sometimes and usually fail to keep people from stripping the resources. And I think that's really relevant to what happens with whales. There's almost no incentive for restraint. The honest whalers spend all their time complaining about the dishonest whalers, the ones they know are breaking the rules.
Yeah, so here's Norway trying, even though it's a whaling country, culture, economy, all tied up with whaling. They're trying, but then other countries are just saying, okay, great, more whales for us.
More whales for us. And the prime example of tying back to flag of convenience is Aristotle Onassis, who is, of course, a hero throughout the seacoast of New Hampshire for his economic development plans. He's famous, of course, for trying to bring an oil refinery to Durham and use the Isles of Shoals as the deposit point for the tankers, which is a crazy idea from the 1970s. And Aristotle Onassis, of course, did whatever he felt like. And so he got word in the 1940s that whaling was incredibly productive and a great way to make money fast. He admitted it was basically gambling. And he got a hold of an American tanker and was converting it to a whaling ship and was going to register it in Honduras because Honduras had no whaling regulations. And only somebody from the Fish and Wildlife Service who figured this out realized that they could block the transfer of the ship to Honduran registry because of American law. So he was forced to find a country that had signed the whaling commission, and he found Panama, which didn't even realize it had signed the convention it claimed. And so Panama is probably the closest thing to a villain in the 1950s because they give Onassis shelter. He basically uses the Panamanian flag. And he takes not only the ship, there's an American ship. He calls it the Olympic Challenger. Everything has Olympic in his name in the 1950s. And he fills it with former Quislings, Norwegian Nazis, German whalers who are out of the business because the Americans won't let them back in whaling after the war. So these are all people who can't get jobs whaling anywhere else, but they have skills. And he sends them off on the high seas to catch whatever they can. And he's very open about the fact that, as he once says to his would-be father-in-law, the rules are there are no rules. And off he goes, catching whales from the very first harpoon shot. He's breaking the rules. And so he's using the Panamanian flag to cover himself. And the Norwegians are screaming at the Americans saying, you know, basically,
stop this guy.
Panama is basically your colony. How can you not do anything about that? And the Americans are saying, we're trying. We're telling the Panamanians that they have to enforce it. And we just can't make them do it. And finally, he's stopped by the Peruvian Navy and Air Force, which captures his ships because, being Aristotle Onassis, when the Peruvians say they control 200 miles out in the 1950s from their shoreline, Onassis tells the Peruvians, well, we're already catching whales within 200 miles. And that's, of course, Peru can't just let that go. So they send the Air Force out and actually bomb his ships, and the Navy catches his ships and brings them back in. And eventually that gets him out of the business. But being Aristotle Onassis, of course, he saw this coming and he got his ships insured by Lloyd's of London so that he actually got the British government, which had been criticizing him in 1953-54. Later in 54, the British government was trying to get him out of Peruvian jail, in effect, because the Lloyd's subscribers were upset that they were going to have to pay £3 million to get this guy out of jail, which they probably should have foreseen in the first place.
Well, it's a very colorful story. And of course, he has this young, beautiful wife that all the sailors are looking at and all that.
Yes.
And you know, we're sort of smiling while we're listening to you tell that story. But it's kind of a microcosm, isn't it, Kirk,
yes,
of just all the problems of trying to get these nations together on preserving this population of whales, which everybody agrees is being depleted, and how troublesome it is. I mean, you've got, you know, I don't know how many nations you have in the world, 150, 200,
right,
basically, all sort of saying, yeah, maybe, you know, it's kind of like kindergartners in a sandbox who all want the same truck. I don't know.
That is a pretty good comparison. If the kindergartners invested millions and millions of dollars into having that sandbox and then they felt their economic livelihoods were at stake, because Onassis is the most blatant cheater because he's pretty open about it. He basically says, I don't really care what anybody thinks about me. But everybody understands that there's a lot more cheating going on. The Soviets are doing – not only are they cheating – nobody can figure out how they're cheating because the way the system is set up after World War II, there's a cap put on how many whales can be caught. And when there's a bureau in Norway that keeps track of how many whales are caught, when they get close to the cap, they radio all the whaling expeditions that are following the rules, and they say the cap is coming up. We're going to stop whaling on whatever day, maybe March 14th, something like that.
So come back in.
So come back in. What the Soviets were doing was actually inflating their catch reports so that the cap would be reached sooner. And then when the call came in, everybody should stop whaling. And literally in one case, the Soviets hid behind an iceberg. While everybody headed north, the Soviet ships were hiding in the ice pack. And they just kept whaling. And there was nobody around to report that they were still whaling. At other times, the Soviets were catching stuff and not reporting it at all. And so their numbers were completely false. And everybody understood that their numbers were false, but they didn't know what to do about it. Like, what do you do? You know, you're not going to start a war. You wouldn't do anything about Hungary in 1956. You're not going to do anything about illegal whaling in 1957, 58. But the other big problem with all the Soviet data being falsified was that the data was supposed to provide the whaling commission some sort of framework for figuring out how many whales could be taken. And if the data is all wrong and nobody trusts the data, then the honest whalers aren't going to say, well, we agree that we should take fewer whales if the data is based on obviously fraudulent numbers. So that was the biggest problem, trying to get data that could convince even the hardcore whalers that they needed to reduce their catch to sustain their industry. And most of the big whaling companies in Britain and Norway and even in Japan, they were interested in sustaining their business. They didn't want to go out of business in 4 or 5 years. Although I will say one of the problems that occurs by the 1960s is they figured out they can use their whaling ships for other things. So if whaling ends, they're not bankrupt. So
they can catch other.
They can catch fish. They can go into transport. That they can always find something to do with these large ships.
So the caps were set, Kirk, by the International Whaling Commission.
Yes,
is that right?
Yes.
And when did that body come about? There's a lot of problems with it that you detail in the book.
Yes. So the Whaling Commission was an idea that came out of really out of the United States, but building on ideas that the British and Norwegians had proposed during World War II. Because again, the British and Norwegians are reasonably honorable whalers in the sense that they recognize there has to be some sort of system for maintaining order in whaling. And the United States uses its muscle at the end of World War II to call the nations together that whale and create the International Whaling Commission in 1946 and through a convention that the U.S. drafts. And that convention has as its core that there is a schedule of regulations, and those regulations are set by scientists. The scientists should have access to all the data. And then the members of the commission should be able to vote to approve the regulations that the scientists suggest. But it is very much a political body because the scientists don't get to just decide. They have to convince the political agents on the commission.
And the data is tainted and politicized and full of cheats and so forth.
The data is tainted. And the other big problem in 1946, of course, is there's starvation around the world. So you go to the Dutch and say, you know, you should catch fewer whales because we should have fewer whales. We need to have more whales in 1975. And the Dutch are saying, you know, the Nazis just starved us out for 5 years. We want food now. Don't tell us about the whales.
Same thing with the Japanese.
Same thing with the Japanese. And at least they were, you know, defeated. And oddly, the United States basically says to the Japanese, get back into whaling, even as they're saying to the Europeans, you know, we need to put caps on whaling. And partially that's because General MacArthur was sort of his own government. You know, he got orders from the U.S. and he occasionally read them and even less frequently obeyed them. So there is this sort of dichotomy in U.S. policy. But the key part is that the hunger of World War II makes it really hard for the scientists to sell lower limits on how many whales can be caught.
Well, and MacArthur, you know, he said to his American commanders, you know, give me food or give me bullets, because
yes,
if I can't feed these people,
yes,
you know, I'm going to have to start putting them down by force because they're starving. So in a way, you can kind of see why he said to heck with the whales.
Absolutely. You know what? I found the relative of Hubert Schenck, who was an American colonel, who was actually a geology professor from Stanford, and he finds himself in charge of natural resources for Japan at the end of the war. And so he's trying to figure out what to do with everything from forest products to fisheries to whaling, and he's completely behind putting the Japanese back in whaling. And so I wrote to one of his relatives asking if I could have permission to use some pictures, and his relative said, well, you know, we're kind of embarrassed that, you know, Uncle Hubert was involved. And I said, you know, I don't really think there's any reason for embarrassment. They were really trying to make Japan a functional democratic society that wouldn't be warlike anymore, and they felt that the ocean was a place that Japan could get resources because, frankly, nobody else in Asia was going to give Japan anything in 1946. So Japan had to go get its own resources. And, you know, Colonel Schenck was doing his best to come up with a policy, and he was very much conservation-minded. He did remarkable work saying to the Japanese, you know, your name is mud. You have to use every whale efficiently. You cannot cheat. You have to do everything precisely. And when the occupation authorities leave in 1951, they are bragging about how efficient and Legal, the Japanese whaling art, is they have done it perfectly in their remaking of Japanese whaling.
So if anybody is doing whaling sustainably, it's the Japanese.
Well, you know, I'm not – sustainably is tough because in the ocean's constantly moving, right? I mean, how many whales are there this year versus 10 years from now? Whales are long-lived, so it's a little bit easier than, say, fish, where populations, you know, rocket up and down. The big problem is they really didn't have any idea how many whales were left. And they had a sense, because blue whale catches were declining, that they were taking far too many blue whales. But there were tons and tons of fin whales still out there, and they thought they could take a lot of fin whales. And they didn't know how fast fin whales reproduce. They didn't know they knew basically the important economic stuff, like how when fin whales were fattest and where were the best places
to catch
them.
But they didn't understand the biology and the life cycle.
Exactly. They didn't understand the life cycle, and they were trying to learn that. But, of course, the whalers wasn't really in their immediate interest to figure those things out. They were in a very competitive business. So taking along some scientists so they could dissect whales and figure out, you know, how old a fin whale is, when it can have babies. They need to process that whale. They don't have time to worry about that.
Well, if you ask people today who the villains are in this Save the Whales story, and we'll get to that environmental yes. movement in a couple minutes, Kirk, they might say the Japanese.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of parodies about, you know, Japanese having no heart for the struggling whale populations.
Well, it's true. I think Japan is basically stuck in 1946 when it comes to whaling. And a friend of mine who works on the Whaling Commission Scientific Committee told me early in the process that the Japanese have said on many occasions, well, you guys put us into whaling at the end of World War II and showed us how to do it and, you know, set up the Whaling Commission, which we joined. We had nothing to, the Japanese had nothing to do with creating the Whaling Commission. So I think the Japanese attitude is still very much that efficient use. And the whales are a product of the ocean like fish, and you guys eat steak and we eat whale. What's really the big difference? And they are not sympathetic to the idea that whales are somehow different or special. Now, obviously, this is the official line. There are many people in Japan who think whaling is just a ridiculous industry and it costs them far more than it's worth. But the Japanese currently are not going to give in to any kind of protest because they've dug in. Officially, they've dug in so much of their national prestige that whaling is an acceptable use of the ocean's resources, and that they're the only country in the world that actually really abides by the 1946 convention that created the International Whaling Commission. You can imagine the other 88 members of the Whaling Commission don't like to be told that they're only the Japanese. Know how
well, in 1946 was a long time ago.
It was a long
ago.
Time ago, yes.
Well, and in a couple minutes, Kirk, we'll talk about that 1970s environmental movement, Save the Whales, this idea that, you know, whales are special, whales are different, whales communicate, whales are maybe like us, and how that changed this whole story, this whole industry of commercial whaling. We'll talk about that in just a couple minutes, but right now we're going to check in very quickly with our March Fund Drive.
Good morning. I'm Amanda Loader, and this is NHPR's March Fund Drive. Please give as generously as you can to keep your favorite programs like The Exchange on the air. It only takes 2 minutes to give at nhpr.org or to call 1-888-805-6477 for a phone donation. Joining me today is Michael Brindley.
I have some great news. Somebody called in and cut our hourly goal right in half. $500 gift, a one person step up to the plate and made their contribution to The Exchange. Now it's your turn to step up and do your part to pay for programs like The Exchange, that daily call-in show, the only thing like it in New Hampshire. Pay for that type of programming right now by giving us a call at 1-888-805-6477. Meeting these goals are critical to ensure that we can continue to bring you The Exchange and programs like Word of Mouth in the months to come. So please, once again, that number is 1-888-805-6477, or make your contribution online at nhpr.org.
And there really is nothing like The Exchange. I mean, where else can you call in with your questions and comments, hear what your friends and neighbors think? I mean, this is the state's call-in program, and Laura is an incredibly dedicated host. She spends hours researching, reading, and preparing, and, you know, she approaches her work with this enthusiasm and professionalism and thirst for knowledge that you just don't hear from a lot of other hosts on air. I mean, hosts like Laura are just, they're worth their weight in gold. And she's here, our New Hampshire treasure, and we are asking you to help support programs like The Exchange, her work, and the work of her producers by giving us a call. Maybe chip away at that dollar a day level. We have $500 left here to raise. 1-888-805-6477. 6477 is the number, or go to nhpr.org for a secure web pledge.
$500 to go to reach this hour's goal, about 20 minutes to get there. If you can't make that one-time $500 gift, how about $10 a month? Consider that your subscription to NHPR in the exchange. Not only does that help pay for NHPR, but you get the NHPR baseball cap, one of our March Fund Drive thank you gifts. Spring training, it's underway. The baseball season starts soon. Be on the NHPR team. Show people that you're supporting your favorite public radio station. The hat comes in red or blue with the NHPR logo embroidered in white right on the front for people to see. So give us a call right now. Get that cap at 1-888-805-6477 or make your contribution online at nhpr.org.
And we have $500 left to raise, 19 minutes to do it to make sure that we are on track for this drive. And, you know, listener support, as you're thinking about calling in your gift, it makes up just over 40% of our total revenue here at NHPR. So getting more members, even if it's just 1 or 2% more of the audience, it makes a huge difference in our ability to serve you even better and to keep programs like The Exchange on our air. So please, as you're doing that, consider giving us a call at 1-888-805-6477. You can also make a web pledge at nhpr.org.
That goal now down to $400. The Exchange fans, you're stepping up to the plate. Now, those other people out there waiting to contribute, now is the time. You have 20 minutes to pay directly for programming like The Exchange. You can help us meet this important goal by giving now at 1-888-805-6477. How about a dollar a day? Is The Exchange worth that to you? Ask yourself that. That would nearly get our hourly goal out of the park and done with. Your support helps ensure that the programs you enjoy and the news you trust will be here every day on NHPR. You can also give online at nhpr.org.
And like other strong nonprofit organizations in New Hampshire, NHPR is funded with voluntary contributions that range from a few dollars to a few thousand dollars. We're asking you to choose an amount that fits your budget and reflects the value that NHPR brings to your life and to New Hampshire. If that's $120, if that's $1,200, if that's $2,500, if it's $45, whatever it is, it will ensure that NPR and NHPR programs you want, like The Exchange, always have a home here on our radio. Now we've got $300 left in our hourly goal and 17 minutes to raise it. We would, as Michael says, knock it out of the park with a single dollar a day pledge right here, right now at 1-888-805-6477 or nhpr.org.
If we can get three people to call right now with a $10 a month sustaining gift, this hourly goal is done. It's gone. And we move on to The Exchange. Give us a call right now at 1-888-805-6477. Not only do those people calling right now with a $10 a month gift help pay for The Exchange, they also get this NHPR baseball hat, stylish way to keep the sun out of your eyes and show your support for NHPR, your love for NHPR. Give us a call at 1-888-805-6477 or go online to nhpr.org.
And on commercial radio, you get less than 45 minutes of programming and more than 15 minutes of commercials. For public radio, you get darn near a full hour of content. So it's your financial support that makes that time saving possible. Please call in with your gift now at 1-888-805-6477. And thanks.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 944. Good morning. New Hampshire weather, partly sunny today. Highs mid-30s to around 40 degrees. Winter weather advisory in effect from the Lakes region and Upper Valley areas and northern counties from 8 this evening till 11 tomorrow morning. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Rothweigel Dental Care in Bedford, comprehensive family and cosmetic dentistry devoted to restoring and enhancing the natural beauty of your smile. Information at rothweigeldentalcare.com. And Waldorf Schools of Southern New Hampshire, including High Mowing School, a boarding and day high school offering a curriculum of arts-infused academics, highmowing.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, who cares about town meeting? Join us for that tomorrow. Today, we're talking with New Hampshire author and UNH professor Kirk Dorsey about his new book, Whales and Nations. It's a history of international whaling in the 20th century. Join us now with your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And Kirk, in the book, you talk about the birth of the Save the Whales movement in the 1970s and how important it was to helping preserve whales. Also, how important to this movement underwater recording technology was. Let's hear a little bit of some of that cool underwater whale sound, and then we'll talk about how that shaped the Save the Whales movement. some whale song that we borrowed from the Oceana Project. Again, we're talking about whaling in the 20th century with author Kirk Dorsey. And Kirk, as an audiophile, obviously I've been working in radio for a long time, I thought it was fascinating how important the ability to record whale song was to this movement.
Yeah, I think that when Roger Payne started recording whale songs, many people had heard whale songs because they'd been listening for submarines during the Cold War, and they just thought they were noises. And Payne is a scientist who in the 1970s started explaining in articles, for instance, in Scientific American and other places like that, and then popularized that whale songs actually had meaning, and that this was perhaps the whale's way of communicating via language. And then that burgeoned into a larger discussion about what the language was saying.
Mothers talking to babies.
Mothers talking to babies.
Courting.
And so you get, you know, ads saying that, you know, whales are making love and playing and doing all these things that are like human, but even better because they're not declaring war on one another. And so I think the recordings became a way for people to understand these mysterious creatures that, frankly, most people never see. There was a whale watching industry in the 1970s, but it wasn't very large. And everybody could hear the whale recordings. The Capitol put out a record of just whale recordings. National Geographic in the late 70s had an insert in, that I can still remember our family getting. And it was a little vinyl record that you could put on your record player and listen to the whale songs. And I think that was really one way of communicating this idea that whales had these big brains, and they were sentient. They could think. They could make decisions. And you can't hunt something that not only can feel pain, but it may even be thinking about what's going on. Why am I being attacked?
So this had a big impact, didn't it, Kirk?
It did. And then it was followed up by, I'm sorry because we're on the radio, but the rise of television certainly helped. That, and particularly, as one of my friends pointed out the other day, color television and Jacques Cousteau bringing the oceans alive.
Right.
But even books, Farley Mowat's really fascinating book, A Whale for the Killing, which was published in 1972 and was excerpted in Reader's Digest, drew tens of thousands of letters of protest to the International Whaling Commission and to various governments around the world about whaling policy. So the whale songs, I think, started it, and then the ball kept rolling with books and TV. And then, of course, in the 80s, you've got Free Willy, but in the 1980s, you've got Star Trek with the singing whales being extraterrestrial creatures that had to be saved.
So, okay, I love that movie.
Yeah, well, it was a lot of fun movie.
I've seen it a couple times.
Yes, it was a fun movie, so.
Well, and you write that before this whole whale song and then the movies and Jacques Cousteau and so forth, you know, most people thought whales were just kind of big fish.
Yeah.
And then it was, oh, my gosh, they're mammals. They're like us. They have babies. They have families.
And they're classic examples of the charismatic megafauna because they're mega. I mean, obviously, they're big. But charismatic in that they're doing things. They're not just sort of swimming around eating. They actually are having maybe even some sort of social networks. And actually, Payne argued that the whales were communicating to one another about how to share food. And sometimes the people at the early Save the Whales movement are making an explicit argument that whales are at least equal to people, if not better, morally, and making it therefore hard to hunt them, which is a really fascinating shift because early in the 1970s, the earliest protest against whaling, it's a kitchen sink. They're throwing everything at the whaling government saying, you know, you can't catch whales. And there are documents I found where it'll say on page, actually sometimes in the same paragraph, you know, whales are too special to kill. And then like a sentence later, and besides, if we didn't kill them now and preserve them, we'd have the ability to get a million tons of protein each year from them in the future. Those two sentences don't really go together.
But no, they don't.
It's an attempt to use any argument to persuade people to stop hunting whales. And the whaling, Save the Whales movement eventually sort of coalesced for a variety of reasons around this idea that whales simply were too good to be hunted. So sustainable whaling meant zero hunting.
Well, and accomplished something that decades and decades of international diplomacy was unable to accomplish.
Yes. And actually, the funny thing is the protests in the early 70s got the Whaling Commission, finally gave the Whaling Commission enough muscle to clamp down on whaling and really restrict whaling and let the scientists decide how many whales could be taken sustainably. But by the time the Whaling Commission did that, the Save the Whales movement was way past sustainable whaling is, you know, only taking a few to sustainable whaling means you can't hunt whales at all because – and it's a combination of their moral, but also once you start hunting whales, you're going to go and kill them all. And
that it's this too is difficult.
It's too difficult
to
stop.
As you described earlier, it's too difficult to monitor this thing on the high seas.
Exactly. There's no police power on the high seas.
You've got Soviet ships hiding behind icebergs.
Exactly.
And so forth. Right. Let's hear from our listeners, Kirk. And this is Anne waiting in Newcastle. Hi, Anne. Thanks for calling in. You're on The Exchange.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Anne.
When my husband and I were living in New Hampshire in the late 60s, we were starving students at UNH. And we used to buy whale meat or steak from the Bluefin Fish Market in Portsmouth.
Wow.
It was sold in bricks Each brick weighed 1 kilo, and I think it was $1 a brick. There was no fat. It was completely lean and a little bit bland, but the fish market suggested we soak it in an inexpensive dressing for salad. So we did, and garnished it with bacon strips and baked it like a roast. It was delicious.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. So that's the 60s, Anne.
Yes, probably around 67 or 68.
And I'm guessing it disappeared from the fish market a decade later.
Well, if not sooner, because one time we went and there was only one brick left, and the owner of the fish market said we could have it free because no one else bought it.
Wow, interesting. So there's that whole cultural ethos in this country against don't do this.
Exactly. And the Marine Mammal Protection Act of 1972 would have made it illegal to eat whale in any case, wherever the whale came from. I'd be really fascinated to know where that whale came from.
Yeah.
It could have been Aboriginal hunting from eastern Canada, possibly, or maybe Norwegian whale meat. But it would have had a pretty long journey if it was fresh whale meat. I'm fascinated to know where
it
came
from. But this was in the 60s.
In the 60s. So there, I know there was still whaling going on off Norway and off Iceland, maybe off Iceland. Antarctic whale meat would have had to have been frozen. And by the late 60s, there was not a lot of hunting for for one thing, the fin whale population had basically been decimated, so they were hunting much smaller whales. So possibly it was a minkie whale from the south. I'm really curious to know where that whale meat would have come into New Hampshire.
Well, Anne, it's good to hear from you. Right. And here's a basic question for you, Kirk. So does anybody hunt whale anymore?
Sure. The Japanese are still doing it. They basically say that the Whaling Commission treaty gives them the right, as it does. It says that nations can hunt whales for scientific research. And so the Japanese are using that. And they're catching about 1,000 minke whales a year down in the southern sea, south of Australia. Very controversial.
What's the science or the scientific justification?
Their argument is that nobody really knows how minke whale reproduction works. And so they have to catch a bunch of minke whales and study their ages and reproductive condition and how many have fetuses and things to get a population, in effect, a chart of what a minke whale population looks like. And once they have that data, they will be able to then argue for resumed commercial whaling. And the Whaling Commission is technically open to resuming commercial whaling. Now, there has to be a three-quarters vote of the Whaling Commission. That's not going to happen in my lifetime that three-quarters will do that. So this is the argument, is that the Japanese say the Whaling Commission is supposed to resume commercial whaling, but you can't do that unless you have the data. So how else are you going to get the data? And then once we've caught them, we might as well eat them.
Wait. Given today's amazing technology to, catch, maybe not catch a whale, but, tag animals, track them, do you have to kill them to find out about their reproductive cycles?
Well, once you bring them on board the ship, it's pretty much, to get them on the ship, you pretty much have to kill them. So that is the question. And there are plenty of scientists who say this is bogus science. This is basically just an excuse to catch whales.
Yeah, because you could tag them and follow them with some sort of camera or something, couldn't you?
Probably could. I mean, if you could hit them with a harpoon, you could probably hit them with a camera. But of course, there's no money to be made hitting them with a camera. So, and there is still money to be made selling whale meat. Although the Japanese market appears to be shrinking for whale meat. So it seems to me that what this really is, more than anything, it's the Japanese telling the rest of the world, we are not listening to what you tell us about whales. We're going to do what we want. And, of course, the whole Paul Watson and the whale warriors that's on Animal Planet. I mean, this is all about trying to stop the Japanese from hunting whales. And, again, it's just sort of the mysterious nature of whales, the charisma they have. And the Japanese are basically saying, we have this right on the high seas. It's a treaty right, which it is. And we have an ethical right to take things from the ocean. That's what people do. They take things from the ocean. You take cows. You take fish. We take whales.
So where does this story end up, Kirk? Well, if you were to write the 21st century, or maybe the first decade of the 21st century, what would you write?
I think the first decade of the 21st century is going to be about the changes in the ocean. I mean, in the long run, the real threat to whale populations will be if we actually manage to change, say, the composition of the oceans.
Climate change.
Or if we decide that fish oil from krill, tiny little plankton, a little shrimp-like creature that lives off south, off the Antarctic seas, that is the basis for so many of the whale populations. If we start harvesting krill in huge quantities, we could actually probably do more harm to what's left of the whale stocks than we could through harpooning them.
Because they have nothing to eat.
They would have nothing to eat or have much less to eat. And, there's no Save the Krill movement, although you can get a T-shirt.
You could start one.
I could start one, yes. In my spare time, I'll do that. I don't have the charismatic megafauna, though. They're uncharismatic minifauna. And so there just won't be a Save the Krills movement. And then, of course, there's the whole problem with the garbage in the going into the ocean. I mean, the idea that we have a garbage patch the size of Texas circling around the middle of the Pacific. Admittedly, there aren't a lot of whales there, but that suggests how much garbage there is in the ocean. And there are a few documented cases of whales actually choking on garbage. So, you know, what we're doing to the ocean right now is much greater than simply harpooning whales.
All right. Well, Kirk, it's been great to talk to you. Thank you
so
much.
Thank you very much.
That's UNH historian Kirk Dorsey. His new book is called Whales and Nations. Checking in now with our March Fund Drive.
Thank you, Laura. It's NHPR's March Fund Drive. I'm Michael Brindley, and we're here asking for your support now at 1-888-805-6477. NHPR members support the work of Laura Kanoy and the team on The Exchange. It's interviews like this that keep you tuning in every day. You make all of this possible when you give to NHPR right now at nhpr.org, or once again, 1-888-805-6477. Joining me today is Amanda Loader.
And we have just a little more than 3 minutes left to raise $300. And, you know, what part of that can you help with? Maybe it's $5, $10, or $20 a month on a sustainer plan. Maybe it's a dollar a day. Knock that clean out of the park. Whatever it is, the amount is up to you. But please put a value on all your NHPR listening and on The Exchange by giving right now at nhpr.org or call 1-888-805-6477.
Coming up in just a few minutes is the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to hear about those recalls to General Motors and an outlook at the U.S. auto industry in general. But first, please help make discussions like this possible. The news you need will be here in the months ahead, but if you call right now at 1-888-805-6477 or make your contribution to NHPR online at nhpr.org.
And one of our thank you gifts is the NHPR baseball hat. It's great. It's your typical canvas hat. It comes in red or blue. But this hat also has the NHPR logo embroidered right there on the front. It's a nice, stylish way to keep the sun out of your eyes and also show your support for your favorite public radio station. And you can pick up the NHPR baseball hat for $10 a month as a sustaining gift. If we got three of those, we'd make this hourly goal and then some. So think about that and give us a call and get that hat at 1-888-805-6477. You can also go online at nhpr.org.
The Exchange, simply put, is a New Hampshire treasure. It's unique. It's the only statewide call-in program in New Hampshire. It's the only statewide forum on the radio. Laura and the team bring in guests to discuss New Hampshire concerns and answer your questions when you call in. So support that type of programming right now by calling us at 1-888-805-6477. Discussions like this are only made possible by the support of listeners like you, Exchange fans like you. Make your contribution online at nhpr.org.
And the Diane Rehm Show is coming up here in just a couple of minutes, so show your support by making that call. We have a goal of $300 in the next 90 seconds. These goals are extremely important for us to stay on track to meet our overall goal for this membership drive. The money you give now will go directly to help pay for the Exchange on NHPR, help pay for the Diane Rehm Show. Once again, we need $300, less than 90 seconds to make that, so take that a moment now and go ahead, give online at nhpr.org or give us a call at 1-888-805-6477.
Here's an analogy for you. The Exchange is kind of like a faucet. Every morning at 9 a.m., you turn on your radio, and here comes The Exchange. A seemingly endless supply of news and information comes along with it. But like water, The Exchange is a precious resource. And though you don't need to worry about conserving it, you do need to do your part to preserve it. Preserve The Exchange by becoming a sustaining member right now by giving us a call at 1-888-805-6477 or give online at our website at nhpr.org.
And, you know, people, when they talk about Pledge Drive, you know, after the fact, they say, oh, you know, I didn't know you were talking to me. We are talking to you. We're talking to you right now, and we are calling on you to show your team spirit. Call in and make your pledge to Team NHPR. The number is 1-888-805-6477. Once again, 1-888-805-6477 or nhpr.org.
The Diane Rehm Show is next on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our listeners, and the Palace Theater in Manchester, where the arts come alive, presenting Mel Brooks' Broadway musical, The Producers, March 21st to April 5th. Tickets at palacetheater.org. And from Northeast Delta Dental, providing dental benefits to businesses of all sizes and individuals throughout New Hampshire, Maine, and Vermont. Information online at nedelta.org.